It's 6 after 10. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Well, until about a decade ago, scientists thought that asteroid collisions or collisions with other space debris or with Earth were rare occurrences that pretty much happened a long time ago. Well, it turns out these types of collisions have happened much more recently than we thought and in greater numbers. Fortunately, most of the objects striking the Earth have landed in the ocean, minimizing their impact. So, what does this mean for us today? Well, that's the question we're going to be talking about for the rest of this hour with Greg Easterbrook, a contributing editor to The Atlantic Magazine and The New Republic. Good morning, Mr. Easterbrook, and welcome to the program.
Hi, John.
Well, until fairly recently, we thought that these collisions with space objects were rare and long ago. What happened to change that thinking?
Yeah, that is the received wisdom on this subject. As recently as about 10 years ago, if you'd talked to an astronomer or a cosmologist, he or she would have said that collisions between the Earth and very large asteroids or comets was a phenomenon of the primordial mist that happened billions of years ago on a regular basis, and during the period that mammals have existed, the last few hundred million years, space object strikes have become so incredibly rare that they're just no longer a factor in our calculations and nothing we need to worry about. Well, we'll scratch that. All the research of the last 10 years has shown that space object strikes are far more likely than previously estimated, that they've happened in the geologically recent past. In fact, that they've happened during the period of human civilization, that big, large things continue to hit the Earth on a fairly regular basis, and it's pretty much only by the grace of God that one hasn't hit any landmass in the last 2,000 years. Recent research shows that something pretty big struck the Gulf of Carpentaria off Australia in the year 536. It hit water, so its effect on the global biosphere was smaller than it would have been if it hit land, and of course it left no crater because it hit water, or at least it left no easily visible crater. There is a crater there. It's just hard to see. Had that object struck Kansas, or let's say it struck the city of Miami, we did the calculations, hit with the force of about 1,000 nuclear warheads. Had that object struck Miami, it would have flattened most of South Florida. Many millions of people would have died. And perhaps equally important in the scale of what you should worry about, it would have kicked up enough dust and smoke into the atmosphere to cause several years of nuclear winter-like conditions. Crops would have failed all across the world. It would have been pretty bleak. It looks like somewhere around 5,000 years ago, maybe 4,800 years ago, an object 5 kilometers across hit the Pacific Ocean. Experts generally say that an asteroid about a kilometer across would be enough to cause global ecological damage. This object was 5 kilometers across, and luckily for us, it hit the water. It seems to have caused tsunamis all across the Pacific Basin. The flood stories in the Book of Genesis and the Epic of Gilgamesh date not exactly, but to approximately this time. It's possible that a lot of the landmass of the Earth was temporarily flooded by that strike. And again, if an object of that size hit any landmass in the world now, we might be in for decades without summer. Basically, not only would the land area that was hit be obliterated, but from the global standpoint, we wouldn't see the sun for decades, and human civilization would take a huge step backwards, and the death toll might be fantastic. All this stuff, I can go on, so I don't want to hold the floor, but all this understanding of asteroids, I can give you more details, is really from the last 10 years or so. And the bottom line to it is that U.S. space policy, NASA policy, the White House view of this has not altered one iota. The White House doesn't seem to have any idea that these discoveries are happening.
So how likely is it that something will strike the Earth during this century?
Well, the estimate as recently as 10 years ago would have been that a significant object would strike the Earth once every million years. So to worry about that is like worrying about a plane crash. It's just not going to happen. Now the estimate is there's about a 1 in 10 chance per century that a dangerous object will strike the Earth. That's enough that we ought to care about it right now. And for any of your readers or listeners who are who follow astronomy, you know that roughly 2 weeks ago, something enormous struck the planet Jupiter. And when I say enormous, I mean really enormous. It's left a, what astronomers are calling a scar in the Jovian atmosphere. It's about the size of the Pacific Ocean. So the betting line right now is that whatever hit Jupiter 2 weeks ago was maybe as much as 1,000 miles across. Had that object struck the Earth, you and I would not be having this conversation because human life would no longer exist. Microbial life might no longer exist. The whole surface of the Earth might be inanimate now that the object struck Jupiter. And if you know the celestial mechanics, you know that an object in falling to the solar system is far more likely to strike Jupiter than the Earth because Jupiter is so much bigger and has stronger gravity and for other reasons. But this is not some weird science fiction concern. That 2 weeks ago, the planet Jupiter was rocked by something enormous. 1,500 years ago, our planet was rocked by something deadly. We can do something about this. We can prevent asteroids from hitting the Earth, but only if we wake up and act before one does.
Well, I want to give the phone numbers because I know people are going to want to ask a lot of questions, and I'd like to get to calls as soon as I can. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number to use to join the program. You can also send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Well, let's talk about Jupiter for just a moment because there were a number of news articles after the discovery that an object had struck Jupiter and left this big scar the size of the Pacific Ocean. That Jupiter is both kind of our protector because it attracts, its gravity well is big enough to attract things to it that might hit us. On the other hand, it also draws things into the solar system that might hit us. So it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Well, I would say that almost any cosmologist would say that one reason that there's life on Earth is the presence of Jupiter and the other gas giant Saturn. They're outside our orbit. Things that infall toward the sun tend to be sucked up by them with a standard vacuum cleaner sort of action. We can thank our existence in part the fact that we live in a solar system where there are a couple of gas giants outside the orbit of the Earth, and the scientists who are looking for extraterrestrial life are trying to find star systems similar to our solar system, are looking for both Earth-like planets and Earth-like planets in a star system with a gas giant on the outer edge, because we think that would make life on the inner planets much more likely because the gas giant would suck up most infalling comets and asteroids. So, it's hard to get children to eat their broccoli. It's hard to get people to be grateful for things. I don't think the average person's ever going to be grateful that Jupiter is a gas giant on the outside of the solar system, but it does seem to protect the Earth quite a bit. But it's no guarantee that no big thing is not going to hit us. We know that big things have hit us in our past. We're learning that big things have hit us in our recent past. Your listeners who follow paleontology know that roughly 12,000 years ago, there was a mass extinction in North America. The woolly mammoth, the saber-toothed tiger, the glyptodont, all those forgotten creatures all disappeared at the same time. We've been debating for decades what the cause was. It's not determined. There are many possible theories, but recent research shows that a comet hit the upper atmosphere above Canada about 12,000 years ago. And the comet may have pretty much set fire to North America. And the strike of that comet coincides with a mass extinction in North America. Those two things seem unlikely to me to be a coincidence.
And there was a civilization here that was wiped out at the same time, was there not?
Well, the disappearance
the
of the Clovis people is a long-standing conundrum of paleontology. The Clovis people were well south of where the comet hit, but it might have triggered so much atmospheric disturbance and years of sudden winter and crop failures and things that it might have had something to do with their demise. The demise of the Clovis people is not understood and very tightly debated. But it does look pretty clear that a comet exploded in the upper atmosphere above Canada just about the same time that a lot of the megafauna of North America began to die off. And since you and I, human beings, are megafauna and we don't want to die off, we should be concerned about this.
And one of the things that you mentioned, the comet, it's not always things striking the Earth, but things exploding in the atmosphere. And I guess it depends on the angle that they come in at. If it's a shallow angle, they're likely to explode. If they come in at a steeper angle, they're likely to get through the atmosphere and actually strike the surface. But there was the the Tunguska. In Russia, you had that, and we think there may have been a number of other instances where things exploded in the atmosphere rather than striking the Earth, but they still have devastating consequences.
Yes, some of your listeners may think, well, why should I care about what happened 5,000 years ago, even though geologically that's quite recent. Just one century ago, in the year 1908, probably an asteroid exploded above a remote area of Siberia in a place called Tunguska. This has since been the subject of X-Files episodes and other things. You know, was it a star cruiser with a malfunctioning star drive? No, it was a big rock. But actually, sadly, it wasn't a particularly big rock. The rock was probably only 100 meters across, maybe even smaller than that. And when it compressed and exploded in the atmosphere, it detonated with the blast force of about 100 nuclear warheads. Had that rock detonated above Paris or Tokyo, those cities would no longer exist. Fortunately for us, it detonated above remote Siberia. But that was just a century ago. There are still people alive on the Earth who were babies when that happened. For us to think that we don't have to care about this, it's never going to happen to us, this accident's going to hit somebody else, it's somebody else's planet's going to get hit, not our planet, this is very short-sighted thinking.
We need to take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Greg Easterbrook and with you as well. We have a lot of callers who want to get in on this discussion. We'll take calls after the break. Still one line open for you if you want to call right now at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you get a busy signal, feel free to send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 19 minutes after 10 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. National Public Radio recently posted listeners' 100 best beach books ever, summer reading favorites of all time. What books do you remember? Join the conversation and share your favorite reads of the summer's past and present on At Issue with Ben Marins after 5 o'clock today. Well, this hour we're turning our attention heavenward as we contemplate large objects out in space that might strike the Earth. It may be much more likely than you thought. In fact, there's a 1 in 10 chance that something significant will strike the Earth in this century. My guest this hour is Greg Easterbrook, a contributing editor to The Atlantic and The New Republic. He joins me by phone, and so do a whole lot of other people. Let's go to the phones and take a call from Bill in Waukesha.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm curious, when you talk about one of these meteors hitting the ground and how devastating it's going to be if it's a big enough piece, it's going to kick up dirt and dust into the air. Why is it rain won't wash the air out? I don't understand that. And I'll listen off the air.
Thanks for that. Why wouldn't rain wash the air out, or snow, or some other form of precipitation?
It would, but over a course of time that we wouldn't like. MIT in Massachusetts has done fairly elaborate computer simulations of what space rock strikes would do to the atmosphere, including what the meteor. We know that a meteor struck Arizona about 50,000 years ago, because you can go and visit the crater, including what that meteor did. And what happens is you throw so much dust, smoke up into the atmosphere. Remember, you have to visualize what an impact of 1,000 nuclear warheads would be, and the object itself is moving at 25,000 miles an hour or faster. So you're fusing a lot of rock on the ground. You're throwing smoke and dust up into the air. You're throwing a lot of things that will turn into acid up into the air. Following a space rock strike, we would have basically acid rain from hell. And it takes several years for all this stuff to wash out of the atmosphere, possibly as long as several decades, depending on the severity of the strike. Remember when Mount Pinatubo erupted in the Philippines in 1992? It took about 3 months for the effects of that explosion to wash out of the global atmosphere. We had a cold winter and a cold summer following, and that was just a volcanic eruption, which Pinatubo's eruption would be relatively modest compared to the effect on the atmosphere you would get from the strike of a decent-sized space object.
And of course, when that stuff all comes down, and as you said, you've got acid rain from hell, and then you've got all this other stuff that comes down that probably isn't good for anybody either.
Well, your main concern, the global ecological concern, would be the sudden absence of sunlight. The sun would be blocked. You'd have cold summers, late frosts, etc., and you could have global crop failures. That would be, you know, by far my main concern, though the acid rain wouldn't be fun for anybody. One reason that the forecast Malthusian calamities of the post-war era have never happened is that for every year except one since World War II, global agricultural yield has increased more than the global population has, that the words crop failure have just fallen out of the global political vocabulary. Imagine if all over the world crops failed. This would become a more important concern than everything else on the planet combined.
Hmm. John in Madison, you'll be next. Good morning, John.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about the danger of this. It's not just a rock being thrown up in the air, you know, these millions of tons. It's also the vast forest fires that have started that result in all this smoke. And the Cretaceous extinction, the Chicxulub crater off of Yucatan, has pretty well been proven to have happened 64 million years ago by iridium sprinkling across the rock beds, and that provided the niche for our mammals to develop and humans to develop. But my understanding is that, and I don't know what they use as a criteria for significance, but one truly significant or dangerous strike occurs once every 250 years. What I heard a couple of years ago when they had a couple movies about this same scenario was, though, that the Defense Department is well aware of this and has been using this scenario to get drum up support for the populace to support military bases on the moon and Mars. What use would these military bases be as far as destroying one of these meteorites versus, say, launching missiles from this planet?
Okay, that's a bunch of questions. First, I'll tell you that, yes, there was a box office success movie about a decade ago starring Bruce Willis and some dashing, unbelievably good-looking people who ran to a space shuttle and blasted off into space and saved the Earth from destruction by a comet. It was a good movie, the physics in it didn't make any sense at all. One reason that NASA and Washington policymakers have been shy about dealing with the asteroid threat is that they don't want to sound like they're living in a bad Bruce Willis science fiction movie. I think this is actually a significant factor in the psychology of this issue. When you say asteroid strike, people say, oh, yeah, I saw that Bruce Willis movie, and it makes the whole thing sound silly and Hollywood and nonsensical. Unfortunately, the fact that Hollywood's made a silly movie about something doesn't mean that it's not going to be a threat. There is a tension between NASA and the Air Force on this. Yes, your caller is correct, although I don't think it's exactly as he thinks. NASA and the Air Force, bear in mind, have approximately equal space budgets. The Air Force space budget, which you don't hear much about, putting satellites and other objects into orbit, nearly as big as NASA's. There's been bureaucratic tension between the Air Force and NASA on Capitol Hill for a long time, basically since the end of the Apollo program. The Air Force feels that space is a natural extension of its mission. They feel that NASA is feather-bedded and blundering, and we could debate NASA if you wanted, but that's the Air Force view anyway. And they've tried to get missions and roles away from NASA in the past. The fact that NASA is ignoring the space rock threat, in fact, incredibly determined to ignore the space rock threat for reasons we could talk about if you wanted, has created a bureaucratic opening for the Air Force. The Air Force is building in Hawaii the first large telescope that's customized to look for near-Earth objects. One reason that we're discovering near-Earth objects so quickly in the last 10 years, and I can give you the statistics if you want, is that traditionally astronomers have looked into the far heavens. Only recently have they begun to look close to the Earth. The Air Force is building a telescope called Pan-STARRS that will be customized for looking close to the Earth. They expect to find a hugely greater number of near-Earth objects than the current estimate is, and probably at that point they will go to Congress and say, fund us to do a defense. I hope they do, because I want somebody funded to do a defense. Probably it would have nothing to do with a presence on the moon or on Mars. Mars is totally conjectural at this point, but I suppose we could build something on the moon. NASA wants to, or at least claims it wants to. Probably any kind of asteroid defense would be based on launching rockets from Earth, and we could talk about how it would work if you want. But the Air Force is aware of this. In fact, they just did an elaborate war games exercise about a month ago. The Air Force simulated what it would be like if a one-kilometer object was approaching the Earth. And the bottom line of the war game was that we couldn't do a damn thing about it.
Well, I want to back up just a second, because one of the things we haven't talked about is what these objects are and where they're coming from. Why are they in the neighborhood?
Well, I wish it was social calls. As recently as a couple of decades ago, it was believed that most of the rocks in the solar system were in what's now called the asteroid belt, although I expect its name to change soon. There's clearly a belt of asteroids between the orbit of Mars and Jupiter. And the understanding of what the threat was based on the behavior of the asteroid belt. The number of asteroids in the asteroid belt isn't that gigantic by cosmic scale, and most of them are orbiting far away from Earth and not coming toward us. And then you would look farther out into the solar system for comets. There are long and short-period comets. Short-period comets like Halley's Comet come zooming past the Earth on some relatively short time scale. Long-period comets orbit by as much as the millions of years around the sun. And the feeling about comets was there was a relatively small number of them that actually entered the solar system. If you went out past the orbit of Pluto, you would find this place called the Oort cloud, where there are believed to be billions or even trillions of comets, but they're far away and they never come here. So that was what any well-informed astronomer would have told you, let's say, about 20 years ago. About 15 years ago, the Kuiper Belt was discovered. It turns out if you go out to the orbit of Neptune, there's a second asteroid belt with far more asteroids in it than what we call the asteroid belt. I mean, far like by a factor of 1,000. Those asteroids appear relatively unstable. That is, they can be knocked out of their orbit and come in toward the inner solar system. I think that's eventually going to be called the asteroid belt. And what we call the asteroid belt now outside the orbit of Mars is going to be renamed, the junior belt or something. I don't know what we'll call it. But it turns out the real asteroid belt is out farther out in the solar system. The current estimates of the Oort cloud are tending to shoot way up in the amount of material that's there. And the understanding of what perturbs those objects and causes them to fall in to the inner solar system is changing also. There are a number of theories. We probably don't have time to go over all of them, but suffice to say the bottom line is current thinking is that it's much more likely for a comet in the far, far from Earth in the Oort cloud to be perturbed and fall inward toward the inner solar system than was thought as recently as a couple of decades ago.
Well, let's go back to the phones because we have full phone banks again. And if you call now and you get a busy signal, go ahead and send us an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. We'll go next to Bruce in Racine.
Yeah,
Bruce, good morning.
I think we've already tried to take and deflect a large asteroid or something and didn't succeed. If you take a close look at the historical record of ancient Babylon, and that's in the book of Genesis that the Jews brought us, The story of the Tower of Babel seems to be just such a thing, and they didn't succeed, and their third of the earth was destroyed and all that kind of so on and so forth. Either we were shooting at something coming at us, or we were shooting at the moon, which would give us the mirrors that we can see real easy on this side. That's
well,
it.
I don't know if there was a space program during the days of Babylon, but the question everybody asks is, okay, so we see an asteroid coming, what would we do about it? In the Bruce Willis movie, the dashing, good-looking young men and women fly their space shuttle out to plant nuclear bombs and actually it's a comet in that movie and to blow it up. Maybe that's what would happen. And the most recent Air Force war game on this subject took a sort of brute force approach to the solution, that we would fire real large nuclear bombs toward the asteroid and try not to blow it to smithereens, but to change its course. It's possible that that's what you would do. It's possible the solution would be simpler and less impressive. If we have a real good understanding of the orbital dynamics of a space object, and that would require improved telescopes, for example, like the one the Air Force is building, it could require, and I would certainly back, a space-based radar that's designed to examine nearby Earth, or a space-based infrared telescope is another possibility. NASA has proposed one, by the way, but Congress didn't fund it. The price was about $1 billion to study the vicinity immediately around Earth and get a real good understanding of the courses of the objects there. If you had a real good understanding of the courses of objects, you would only need to alter their course by a little bit to get them to miss the Earth, because most of these objects are not falling toward the Earth based on Earth's gravity. Their angular momentum is far more powerful than Earth's gravitational exertion. You just want to be aware of the one that's kind of pointed at the Earth to begin with anyway. And if you know its course exactly, and you change its course just by a tiny bit, all you got to do is cause it to miss the Earth, and then your problem is solved. If your listeners go to their computers and type in B612 Foundation, that's B612, like the name of the asteroid that the little prince lived on in the story, you'll find there's a small foundation run by a former Apollo astronaut named Russell Swigert, who proposes what I was just talking about, how we would improve our understanding of the courses of asteroids and then change their course. He wants NASA to mount a mission to test our ability to change the course of an asteroid, and it would not necessarily involve enormous nuclear explosions in space or that kind of stuff. A gentle nudge on the side of the rock might be all it takes, if we've got a good enough understanding of the rock's course.
Here's an email from Jim in Madison, who says he's enjoying the discussion, and he goes on to say, your guest mentioned that the White House is doing woefully little in this area. Presumably he meant research, because I can't imagine that us humans trying to stop a collision. I wish your host had followed it up. In any case, I would appreciate asking this question. So why isn't the White House more engaged in this?
I think what's going on is that the NASA is a relatively small concern to the White House. I mean, it's slightly less than 1% of the federal budget. Some parts of the agency work just fine. The science research, deep space research kind of stuff in the agency is working just fine. The manned space program is politically controversial because what the heck is it for? What's the space station for? Nobody can answer that. When the White House talks about this, they tend to debate the political aspects of the manned space mission, the space station, now the proposed moon base, and they tend to hear only from two constituent groups. One is NASA, which wants nothing changed in any way. For 40 years, NASA's mantra has been, no one can change any of our programs for any reason. And then you hear from the congressional delegations of the places in Alabama, Texas, California, and Florida and Maryland, where the big manned space spending is, and they say the same thing, don't ever change anything for any reason. There isn't a constituent group that really speaks for the asteroid concern, and although there is an annual conference here in Washington now on that subject. And I think because this is a low-order issue for the White House, when they hear somebody mention it, they think, oh, man, that Bruce Willis movie, come on, we're not going to act like we believe that Hollywood is right about this. I think no credible group of scientists has ever gone to the White House and said, it's time to take this seriously. I think if a credible group of scientists did so, there would be action from any administration, but nobody's ever done it.
Well, is this still controversial within the scientific community? I mean, the findings it took a long time to break through. I believe your article in Atlantic mentions a geophysicist named Dallas Abbott, who had a kind of a breakthrough on how many objects really were striking the Earth. Has the idea that there's a 1 in 10 chance that some object might strike the Earth in this century, has that gotten through to the whole scientific community, or is there still a lot of debate about it?
Oh, there's still debate, and I can tell your listeners, if you go, the June 2008 Atlantic Monthly magazine has my cover story laying out everything we're talking about in great detail. So the Atlantic website is theatlantic.com. Go there and you can read in detail. Yes, so there's still a great deal of controversy. All these things are estimates. We can't be sure what the we could be sure if we increase the research program, but we can't now be sure what the threat to the Earth is. There are some researchers who don't believe that the evidence of a space strike in 536 AD is correct. They believe that the evidence points to something else. That's controversial. The estimate of 1 in 10, which comes from the Aerospace Corporation, which sounds like a corporation but is actually a quasi-government agency. It's the Air Force's think tank. That's debated. you could certainly find researchers who would tell you, oh, come on, it's, you know, once in a million years one of these things is going to hit the Earth. There's a lot of debate. Most of what we understand about the far past is speculative and subject to debate. We could resolve these debates by increasing research spending on this subject. If we built NASA's planned near-Earth infrared observatory in space, cost $1 billion, that's real money, but then we would know for sure what's in the immediate neighborhood of the Earth, and we'd know for sure what their courses were, and then we'd have a much better handle on what the level of threat is.
800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's the toll-free number to join the program. A couple of lines are open right now. If you'd prefer, you can also send an email. The address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We're talking about the likelihood of some large space object, an asteroid or a comet, something on that order, striking the Earth. And some research suggests that there's a much better chance of this happening, and perhaps in our lifetime, than has once been thought. And we're talking about what may be done about it, and the science behind all of this and the controversy surrounding it, and what a horrible calamity it would be if something like this did in fact occur. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take some more phone calls and have a few more questions for our guest, Greg Easterbrook, who's a contributing editor to The Atlantic and also to The New Republic. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:39. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller is up next after the news. And among other things, during his 90 minutes of programming this morning and early this afternoon, they'll be talking about the Perseid meteor shower. So astronomy on our minds for the rest of the morning, actually, at least part of it. By the way, right after 11, Larry's going to be talking with the author of a book about retirement communities. Much more in store here on the Ideas Network today. This hour, we're talking about asteroids or comets or other space debris striking the Earth and how likely that is. It may be a lot more likely than has traditionally been thought. And we're discussing that topic this morning with Greg Easterbrook, a contributing editor to The Atlantic and The New Republic. Let's take a call next from Reed in Clintonville. Reed, good morning.
Hello, fellas. Recently I had an opportunity to visit for the second time Meteor Crater in Arizona, just west of Flagstaff. And if a person wants to witness firsthand the power of just a very small object striking the Earth at a relatively low angle, there's the place to go. It always is extremely impressive. The other comment I want to make is actually a question I was going to ask about whether or not the VLA, that very large array in New Mexico, which is, again, extremely impressive to visit, any part of that is dedicated to searching the skies for unusual and possibly impact objects. And I'll just hang up and listen to the answers. Thanks much.
Reed. Thanks for the call.
I think the answer for that telescope is no, that it's sometimes used for near-Earth searches, but there isn't a large dedicated near-Earth search telescope in existence today. There is one being built in Hawaii, Pan-STARRS, by the Air Force, and there are others proposed. Most telescopes that exist today were designed to look far into space, either into the far heavens outside our galaxy or to other star systems. They weren't designed to look at nearby space, and in part because nearby space just didn't interest astronomers that much, and of course the chance of some sort of career-making discovery seemed a lot greater far off in the galaxy and elsewhere than it did in our own solar system. But we need to improve our ability to understand what's happening immediately around us in the solar system, especially with a rising awareness that space rock strikes, say that five times real fast.
I don't think I will.
Okay. Are far more likely than previously assumed. We need more research. We need more telescopes and ones that are designed specifically to look in nearby space. probably the ideal such telescope would itself be in space, and we sure need them. And, you know, maybe if we had a fantastic network of near-Earth observational facilities, both on the ground and in space, we would eventually discover that there isn't anything coming our way that threatens us. That would be great knowledge to possess, and it would certainly be worth a couple of billion dollars of the public's money, considering how we're wasting the public's money on other stuff, to know that we were secure from a space rock strike for the immediate future. That would be valuable public policy information.
Well, it seems to me from listening to what you've said about how we look at space that, in effect, what we're doing is we're going down the road and we're navigating by looking in the rearview mirror, because the telescopes looking at deep space are looking at the past. And so we're not looking at what's in front of us on the road, that pothole we might drop into, or the large animal that just walked into our path. We're driving down a highway at night with the lights off, and we're looking in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, but we're blindfolded, so it's not actually that good. Yeah, you're right. We don't know anywhere near enough about this subject. We're a rock on its way to strike the Earth to appear today. Of course, we would be helpless if it happened next year or the next 2 years. For the immediate future, we're helpless. But on a relatively manageable time scale, say a decade, we could dramatically increase our understanding of what's in the nearby solar system and what's coming toward us. And probably, not definitely, but probably we could come up with some kind of reasonable effective defense that would be cost-effective as well as technologically effective. These things seem to me to be good goals. And when you consider that NASA is now proposing to waste $500 billion building a Motel 6 on the moon that has no justification whatsoever other than to funnel budget money to NASA. There's just no scientific purpose. It's not even clear there's a political purpose. NASA's willing to waste hundreds of billions of dollars on that just so that all the congressmen in the right districts stay fat and happy, as opposed to spending a few billion dollars to find out if the Earth really is in any kind of peril from space rocks. And if it is, and if NASA stops a space rock strike, this would be, you know, arguably the single greatest achievement in all of human history. I mean, people say the space agency NASA lacks a mission. How about a mission of the single greatest achievement in all of human history? And we're not even working on it, even though it wouldn't be particularly expensive. While we are happy to throw billions to hundreds of billions of dollars toward building a motel on the moon.
Well, you use the word we, and we're talking about the United States, but something striking the Earth affects everybody. What are other countries? What are other countries doing in this area? What's the feeling elsewhere around the Earth about whether or not this is a credible threat and what we ought to do about it?
I think other countries are concerned. It's pretty, you know, if you're India or China, this could be pretty low on the list of your priorities. The European Space Agency has discussed some sort of space rock course-altering experiment. They haven't actually funded it yet, but they have discussed it. Everybody looks to us, the United States, as the leader in all things wealth, technology, et cetera, to be the one to act first. I think we should be the one to act first. But yes, you're right, there would probably be an international aspect to any action. Suppose the United States did develop some technology and some dangerous space rock was reliably believed to be headed toward the Earth. Well, if you were the French or the Dutch or the Indian government, you would want some input into how the intercept was carried out. You would not want to hear the U.S. Air Force saying, "Don't worry, we're launching some nuclear bombs into space. We're just trying to protect you." Even if that was true, you wouldn't want to hear that. You would want to be consulted on this. So if there ever is an intercept of a dangerous space object, I think it would go best if it was an international project, even though, of course, making it international would make it more cumbersome and bureaucratic and all that stuff. You would need to build up a political consensus around the decision.
Back to the phones, and Jack in Green Bay will be next. Jack, good morning.
Morning, John. Very, very interesting. I think it's almost ironic that on my way from Green Bay to Appleton, I was listening to the Moody Blues, I Know You're Out There Somewhere, and then I turned on your Wisconsin
Great
Public
song.
Radio. You're Mr. Easterbrook, you mentioned earlier that the administration is doing nothing or very little, and I heard some of the comments from some of the callers. But it brings to mind that we're going into a technology world that's going to be solar-powered. Don't you think there must be some contingency plan of some sort to keep the old internal combustion engine, or assuming this is going to happen in 50 years, because once this collision would occur and we would have a nuclear winter and whatnot, doesn't that make inoperable pretty much anything powered by solar power? And I'll hang up and listen to your comments on my car radio. Thank you.
Even as somebody who doesn't like Exxon very much, I don't think they're engaged in a conspiracy to block out the sun. I just don't think it's that bad. I think Washington is much more often driven by bureaucratic inertia and the silliness of our federal government institutions than it is by conspiracies. And I think in this case, there's just bureaucratic inertia. NASA for 40 years has been saying, let us do a space station and then let us do a moon base. There are interest groups that benefit from that politically, and they donate to the right congressional committee chairman. That's why you don't get a hearing for asteroid defense. Obviously, if the president got involved in this personally, policy would change very rapidly. Obviously, if Congress ordered the space agency to work on asteroid defense, they would follow the Congress's orders. But there aren't people who are particularly concerned about this right now, not because they're trying to think that they would profit from the aftermath of an asteroid strike, just because there's a lot of inertia on this issue. And the science community, I wish that the National Academy of Sciences or the American Association for the Advancement of Science would take a strong, proactive policy position on this and say to the president in dramatic terms, we now understand that there's a greater threat than there once was, and we think we can fix the threat relatively cheaply, so let's get to work. Let's not have it be the year 2014 and an asteroid's about to hit Los Angeles and there isn't a damn thing we can do about it, and then we spend decades not only cleaning up the mess but pointing fingers and trying to decide who was to blame for the inaction.
Well, I would think, though, that given the fact that the healthcare debate has sucked all the oxygen out of the room, and before that it was the world economy going into the tank, it's pretty hard, even if you had a concerted effort, it would be pretty tough to get anyone's attention because we're so focused on the fact that we just dropped a 100-pound rock on our foot, and the pain is all that we can think about.
Yes, there's no lack of things to worry about at the moment, although actually objectively, you know, global trends are basically pretty good. There's certainly no lack of things to worry about, and there's no lack of people who are calling crisis for anything from genuine crises to just exaggerated political complaints. So to try to get another crisis horned into here would be hard politically. The White House would, I think, the first level of response would be to say, oh, come on, we're trying to deal with the economy and healthcare. Don't talk to us about comets from outside the solar system. But I think if the issue was presented correctly, it would not be a sky is falling emergency sense. It would rather be that this is more of a concern than we previously thought. We need to find out exactly what the details are with improved research. And then if there is a threat, we need to get to work on the threat, which can probably be countered relatively cheaply. I think that's what I've just described as a political pitch that you'd think would succeed, even during a slack economy year. To have a space rock defense would be buying an insurance policy. The ideal outcome is that your insurance policy is never used. But the insurance policy would be relatively cheap compared to the incredible benefits we would realize if we stopped a large object from striking the Earth.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Carla in Oshkosh next. Carla, good morning.
Good morning to you, and thank you for your guest. My question is this. The solar output is down right now, and it's said that we're in a century-class minimum period, and they're comparing it to, like, Dalton minimum and even stretching it as far as, say, Maunder minimum. If during times of low solar output and our heliosphere, instead of expanding, is in a contraction phase, what effect would that have on, let's say, the Oort cloud, which is outside the heliosphere, or the Kuiper belt, which is just inside the heliosphere? And I was wondering if your guest could comment on that.
Well, your caller makes a reference to another issue in astronomy going on right now. All a new sunspot cycle should be in progress. It should have begun about a year ago, if our understanding of sunspots is correct. All the predictions were that the sun would be covered by spots around now, and instead the sun is absolutely clean. There's no sunspot anywhere to be seen. The surface of the sun looks almost eerily calm, if calm is the right word for the sun. What does this mean? We don't have the slightest idea. Scientific understanding of Sol is very modest. Theories of solar cycles are themselves quite speculative. We have only theories about what goes on inside the sun and what it means. You call a reference to the heliosphere, the area around the solar system that has charged particles and solar wind. Probably that area is shrinking right now. We thought it was about to expand. It's probably shrinking. Does that have something to do with whether things fall toward the inner solar system? You know, your guess is as good as the guess of the next chairman of a physics department. Our knowledge of the sun is just, considering that our life depends on the sun, our knowledge of the sun is shockingly modest. And that's another area where I would much rather NASA be spending to increase our knowledge. Relatively small sums spent increasing our knowledge of the structure of the sun would be a lot more beneficial to the average person into public policy debates, especially since we're debating global warming, than would be building that motel on the moon that NASA is so enamored of.
Well, let's take a call from John in Rhinelander next. John, good morning.
Oh, yes, hi. Great discussion this morning. I just have a couple questions for the guest today. I was watching a documentary a while ago on either the Discovery Channel or National Geographic, one of the two, and they said that the scientists had found that in 2010 there's going to be a meteorite and an asteroid. I can't remember which one, but it should be flying so close to Earth that I think it actually is supposed to enter our atmosphere, but then have enough propulsion to ricochet off. And they predict that it won't do any damage. But I was just wondering if you heard anything about that. And also, I was like to comment on the motel on the moon thing. I read that they're planning on using it as sort of a waypoint in between Mars. And I know they're working on different ways to use plasma as fuel to increase speed so we can make trips to Mars routine. Of course, this is all just in, you know, planning and studying phases and stuff like that. But what if they were able to actually put not just a motel, but actual, you know, research devices like new telescopes, new devices and stuff like that on either Earth or Mars? I mean, how much farther would that help us see? Would that help us at all, or would that benefit us? And I thank you for taking my call.
Two questions there. The first is, are scientists expecting an asteroid to enter the atmosphere in the year 2010? Not to my knowledge. And it's hard to imagine how an asteroid could enter the atmosphere and then bounce off again. Once a space object begins to heat up and compress as it makes contact with the atmosphere, it's either going to hit us or explode. If there are skipping stones in space, we don't know about that yet. What you may be thinking of is that this last March, a large asteroid passed within 48,000 miles of the Earth. That sounds like a long way away. It's really not. That's well inside the orbit of the moon. The moon is 300,000 miles away. And in fact, 48,000 miles is just a little bit above the level at which communication satellites are stationed. So something basically skimmed the surface of our atmosphere about last March, and we didn't know about it until a day before it got here. That's when astronomers first noticed it. There was a rock approaching. We had about one day's worth of warning, which isn't a lot, is it? Should we go to the moon as part of a mission to Mars? Human beings will set foot on Mars someday. I would love to see it. I don't know if it'll... I'm 56. I kind of doubt that will happen during my lifetime. The technical obstacles are... It's not that they can't be overcome, but they're great, very great, and the cost is very hard to justify based on other priorities here on Earth. But would going to the moon make it easier to go to Mars? That's what President George W. Bush said when he announced the Moon Base Initiative in 2004, and it's complete scientific nonsense. I shudder to the thought of the White House science advisor signing off on the Bush's Bush's statement in 2004. From a standpoint of propulsion and how objects travel, to land on the moon on the way to Mars is nonsensical. You would use up almost all of your fuel landing on the moon and taking off again. What are called mission architecture studies, all the studies of how we would go to Mars, involve spacecraft departing directly from low Earth orbit to the red planet. There would be no stop on the moon. You want to avoid the moon if you want to go to Mars. Is it possible that something would someday be discovered on the moon that would be useful to a Mars flight? Yeah, maybe. I'll give you that. That could happen. Most likely, if we go to Mars, all the equipment, all the fuel, all the resources will be assembled here on Earth.
And we need to leave it there.
Depart from there.
We're out of time, alas. I think we could do hours on this subject. Thank you so much, Greg Easterbrook, for spending this time with us this hour.
Sure thing.
Greg Easterbrook is a contributing editor to The Atlantic and The New Republic. Rob Schroeder produced this program, on-air production by Jalema Noel. Kathleen Dunn is back next week. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.